things in the spiritual life as having to follow a flattering introduction when you're giving a talk. It's great to be back at the LBC. I lived at the LBC. I'm not from around here originally, but I was at the LBC for about 20 years. I moved here in 1980, and I was here until I moved up to Majimaloka in Birmingham in 2000. I remember driving across London Bridge in the top deck of a bus and tearing up, actually, at the idea of leaving London. I loved living in London. I loved the LBC. And definitely having little moments of déjà vu here, sort of looking around. And I mean, a lot of faces who probably weren't born when I left here, but quite a few faces who I know very well. It's just lovely being back in the Shrine Room and seeing people that I know very well. I remember being at a talk by a very distinguished Buddhist scholar called Robert Thurman once, and he was looking out at this audience that was full of Buddhist dignitaries, and he was saying how great it was to see all these familiar faces. And then he explained that he had got to an age where he had no idea what any of those familiar faces were actually called. But then he went on to say, luckily the Buddhist tradition says you can just call them all mother. But anyway, yeah, so lovely to be back here. But before I was at the LBC, sort of like up until the end of, like literally right up until the end of the 70s, I was in Glasgow. I grew up just south of Glasgow, and most of my teenage years were spent in Glasgow. And I wanted to start off with a picture. I'm afraid I've put people to quite a lot of trouble today. Vandana Jyoti, and especially Gus, who had to find me a laptop, find a screen, get the whole thing kind of angled and all the rest of it. And I will show you some other pictures, but mainly it's this picture that I wanted to show you. It's a picture that I saw at an exhibition at the Barbican a couple of weeks ago. Tough call over there in the corner. You can either sit beside the ventilation or you can see the pictures. I think you've made a wise choice. The picture's a picture by a French photographer called Robert Depardon. And he took it in Glasgow in Maryhill in, I think, around the mid-70s. And it was an exhibition recently called Strange and Familiar, I think it was, of foreign photographers photographing the UK. Really, really interesting exhibition. And a lot of the images, quite moving images, actually, including for me, this one. And there's just something, I mean, it's always a bit of a superfluous trying to comment on a strong image, but there was something about, you know, like I knew Maryhill, I lived in Maryhill in the 1970s, and I knew Glasgow well in that time. And you can't quite see it, but you've got this wasteland around most of the area, and this one little fenced off garden, and in the garden a kid turning cartwheels. And there's just something about that image, that kind of vitality, that sort of visceral optimism in the face of this desolation that I thought was very poignant. And get no idea where that guy is now, so I can't do the math, but what, 40 years odd later, I guess he's an adult. I have no idea how the rest of the life after the cartwheel turned out. But, you know, realising it wasn't a sure thing that it was going to turn out well. Got amazing vitality there, but we're affected by the conditions within which we grow. I just thought that image, so many of the images in the exhibition actually were images of human dignity in the face of conditions that could crush it. There's something about that as a theme, I think, that's very poignant, very moving. And slightly more optimistic image. This talk, Vandana Jyoti asked me a while ago for a title, and I was reading a book at the time by a guy called James Hillman, who's an American psychologist, and I was reading a chapter called In a Nutshell. And just as I got offended with Jyoti's email asking me for a title, but I realised that all of, running right through this talk, there's a whole set of images of growth and the conditions that are necessary for growth. It's a real central metaphor in Buddhism. And that idea of a nutshell as the image of what can possibly grow seemed quite apposite, actually. So hence a talk called In a Nutshell. But this image, that Depardon photograph, reminded me of an image that I must have come across when I lived in Glasgow in the 70s. And it was a metaphor, a sort of story told by another American psychologist called Carol Rogers. And one, his sort of main book, a book called On Becoming a Person, I think he's got this fantastic story that has really stuck in my mind. The story is that one winter, Rogers left a sack of potatoes in his basement and then forgot about them for months. And the next time he was in his basement was in mid-spring. He walked down into the basement and the potatoes, or at least some of the potatoes, had sprouted. And some of them had sent, whatever it is potatoes send, like a shoot across the basement floor. And one of them had found the only patch of sunlight on the basement floor and was bursting into whatever potatoes burst into leaf, I suppose. But it really informed Roger's approach to psychotherapy. It was basically saying, hardwired into any living thing is the urge to grow, the urge to become what we potentially are. This little potato finding that one square foot or whatever it was of light that would support its potential, the possibility of growth. And I have to say that image has really sort of stuck in my mind. And it's an image I think you'll find a lot of parallels for in the Buddhist tradition. In 1979, again just before I moved here, so I missed the live lectures, but Sangha Rakshita, the founder of Tri Ratna, gave a set of lectures on a text, interestingly enough, that Robert Thurman translated. Thurman, for those of you who don't know the Buddhist scholarship that well, he's Uma Thurman's dad, if you know Uma Thurman better. But he translated a text called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. And in 79, Banti gave a set of lectures on this text called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. It's the teaching of Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti was a lay practitioner, and this whole text is built around his dialogue with the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. But there's a little passage in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, and what Sangha Rakshita says is that once our basic needs for food, for clothing, for shelter, for leisure have been met, what do we need more than anything else? And he says, surely what we need is freedom. So I'll leave that with you as a question. You can just sort of look at your own experience maybe and figure out if you agree with that, if you think that's true. But what he goes on to say is the real meaning of human life is to develop our distinctively human characteristics, our awareness, our emotional positivity, our responsibility for ourselves and others, and our creativity. But then he says that you can't develop, you can't grow unless you have the conditions that support that growth. You can't grow unless, he goes on to say, you have space, literally and metaphorically, to grow into. We need freedom, and we need freedom from everything that restricts us inside and outside. So that's the sort of basic image that Sangha Rakshita uses in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. And you might or might not agree with that. It'd be interesting again just to see if you do. But when I was reading my Hillman, one of the things Hillman was saying is that there's an urgency to grow, but often you don't know clearly what it is that you're trying to grow out of, what it is that you're trying to grow into. Remember when I first went along to the Buddhist Centre in Glasgow, I think in 1973 would be my first encounter with Buddhism, and I had spent years looking for, and then I couldn't tell you what it was I was looking for. I knew I was looking for something. I did the rounds of everything that was available in central Scotland at the time, which, it has to be said, was not a particularly spiritually rich soil to support spiritual growth. But what was there, I went to, including like the Moonies, for example, and the Church of Scotland, of course. I started off in the Church of Scotland. But it wasn't until I came across Buddhism that there was this real moment of recognition. Whatever it was I was looking for, I had found it. But I still, at that point, in fact, I'm not even sure now, I could tell you quite what it was I thought I had found. So Hillman says, purpose doesn't usually appear as a clearly framed goal. It starts off more likely as a troubling, unclear urge, coupled with a sense of indubitable importance. You know it matters, but it's not totally articulate what it is that matters to you. That there's a push to become something, but not always easy to articulate what it is that we're trying to become. So how do you clarify that sense of purpose? I think I'll come back to this quote in a minute or two. Something that I did recently, Vandana Jyoti mentioned this long retreat that I was on. I did about a 2-month solitary retreat in a friend's house in North Wales. And when Vandana Jyoti was imagining me walking, I also want you to imagine the rain that I was walking through. In North Wales in November and December, 50 days out of 60, it rained, right? And when I say 50 days out of 60, probably more or less, like, continuously for 50 days out of 60. Anyway, excuse me, just a wee moment of catharsis there. But one of the things that I wanted to do on the retreat was just a bit of a reflection. Like, I'd spent about 10 years doing another kind of organisational job in Sri Ratna. I'd come to the end of that. I'd a bit of a break before I had to take up anything else. So it was just this great chance to step back and to have... If you've never done a solitary retreat, they're fantastic. You know, like, you've never had a situation since you were a kid that you don't have any demands on you. Nobody wants your time. You've got no obligations. You do what you want, when you want to do it. It's just an experience of freedom that most of us in our adult lives don't have. So if you ever get a chance to do a solitary, that's a fantastic chance to let your own practice go deeper. Ramp up to it. You can be weak in moments of challenge when you're on your own for the first time in 20 or 30 years. But anyway, I'm on solitary. I'm doing this retreat. Great way of plugging in a little more deeply to my own experience. But one of the things I was doing was study. Study doesn't quite get it, actually. Study, believe it or not, is important in the Buddhist tradition. Buddhism talks about wisdom, and it uses the word prajna. And one little formulation of prajna divides it into three levels. And the first of those levels is what's called shrutamayi prajna. And shrutamayi prajna means wisdom by hearing. Right? And wisdom by hearing means that, in a way, the whole Buddhist tradition is made up of people whose experience is deeper than ours, trying to explain their experience in a way that's helpful. And we learn from people. You hear things that give you a little glimmer of what it is, this incoherent push in us. It clarifies what it is that we're moving towards. So this shrutamayi prajna, when I say study, really what you're doing when you're reading the Buddhist text is you're listening to the Buddha trying to say, look, from where I'm standing, this is how it looks. But this is what my experience was. This might be helpful. And I went off, I thought a couple of months, I could probably work my way through the whole Pali Canon in a couple of months. And just in case, I also took some Tibetan texts, a very thick book of the mind training tradition. I just thought 2 months, the world's my oyster. Ended up studying a single sutta. I spent 2 months just going over and over a sutta called the Satipatthana Sutta, which I believe there were some readings from this morning. And Satipatthana, sati just means, it gets translated as mindfulness. But one of the commentators on the Satipatthana Sutta says, sati as mindfulness almost never gets mentioned, actually. The whole sutta is about awareness. But sati, which is that sort of direct present awareness, only gets mentioned kind of in passing, actually. There's a whole other set of descriptions of the kind of awareness that you're trying to develop in meditation. And there's one in particular that Sangharakshita's got a take on called Sampajanya. And Sampajanya is an interesting description of a certain quality of awareness. It usually gets translated as continuity of purpose. And one of the ways it gets sort of treated is that, you know, like it's just remembering what you're doing moment to moment. You have the odd kind of moment of embarrassment. I was making myself coffee the other day, and instead of putting the scoop back into the drawer that it was supposed to go to, I put it in the fridge, right, in the scoop. So Sampajanya sometimes just gets construed as remembering what it is that you're trying to do in any sort of moment. But actually, Sangha actually has got quite a different take on Sampajanya. And what he's got to say about it, if you take this idea of awareness as a remembering what we're doing from moment to moment, what he says is that what it means is that everything that we do should be done with a sense of the direction that we're trying to move in. So again, we might not be totally clear about it, but there's a push in us. And what he's saying is that Sampajanya is staying connected to that push and starting to notice what it is that supports it, what it is that does not. And he says, you begin to see the direction your life is taking or could take if you were to act differently. And then he goes on to say, well, how do you figure out what that direction is? One of the points he makes is it's hard. You know, like you've got the Hillman quote again, you've got the sense of urgency. You know it's important, but you can't always articulate what it is in us that's trying to emerge, trying to find its way across that basement floor. And traditional ways that the tradition gives you, the Buddhist tradition gives you, meditation is an obvious one. You're starting to look a little more clearly, a little more deeply into your own experience. But interestingly, he says that often you don't see it yourself, and that actually it's in relationship that we start to get clearer about our own experience. And there's a couple of ways that that happens. You know, like I've lived in communities probably most of my life as a practicing Buddhist. And I was thinking the other day, what was it about that I found helpful? And one of the, I mean, totally obvious things is I'm around people who in a lot of ways are more aware than I am. And just watching how somebody responds and having a kind of, not even that I'm learning a conscious lesson, I'm just watching somebody a little more thoughtful, a little more aware, a little more attentive in how they respond, and you learn something. So I think one of the ways that we start to clarify our own emerging direction is you see something being lived a little more fully in somebody else, and something in us recognises that and responds to that. So that's one way that it happens. But he says also you get yourself reflected back quite directly. You tell people what's important to you, and they're asking you about it, they're encouraging you to clarify. So in those moments of communication, you start to understand a bit more deeply what's going on in your own experience. And there's a particular practice that's developed quite a lot in Sri Ratna. And I don't know how many of you have done this, some of the old timers will have, but that there's people living in community. One of the practices is to tell your life story. And you just sort of describe what your life has been like so far. And one of the things that happens in that is you start to see themes in it. It's not until you start to do it as a joined up story that you start to see themes and you start to see patterns, even things that you didn't recognise yourself. I don't often listen to the morning service on Radio 4 on a Sunday morning, but I was trying to catch the train down here from Herefordshire this morning, and the guy on Radio 4, that old aphorism that you live your life forward, but in a way you can only understand it backwards. And it's only when you start to look back at your life and you take a little bit more of a reflective awareness at the shape that your own life has taken, what was important to you, what was it about that was important, that you start to get a sense in your own life of what sometimes kind of incoherently is trying to emerge. So you get this little quote from Bhante. He says, in listening to people's life story, the distinct impression that you get often is that progress towards the spiritual life, and using spiritual life in its broadest sense here, we don't necessarily mean sort of formal Buddhist practice, but something that's allowing that emergence to happen. Progress towards the spiritual life was inevitable. Although there was a goal implicit in everything they did, a goal that gradually became clearer to us as we realised what we really wanted to do. So just that effort of trying to tell somebody else what it is that you think you're doing with yourself. I mean, maybe it's just me, Vandana Jyoti, again, was saying, often I don't know what I think until I've told somebody. It's as much of a discovery to me quite often, but I suspect for most of us that trying to articulate, communicate, and having it reflected back matters. I think that's what spiritual community means. And what Sangharakshita goes on to say is that as that direction in our own life becomes more conscious, you can start to cooperate with it more intentionally and more consciously. You start to get clearer about what's trying to emerge. You start to notice what it is that keeps you connected to that. You start to notice what it is that pulls you away from that. And you learn how to make that emerging current in our lives a more kind of sustained experience. Traditionally, Sangharakshita said, Buddhism has given that goal a name, what it is that is trying to emerge, and the name is enlightenment. And then he goes on, for all human beings, the implicit purpose of human life is to grow and develop. If we look carefully enough, we can find that thread of meaning running through our lives. And then I find a really interesting little one-liner, it's the function of the Dharma to help us to find it. So in a sense, before the Dharma is anything about Buddhism, before enlightenment is anything about Buddhism, it's the clarification of what it is that's trying to emerge in us and what it is that connects us to that and that keeps us connected to it. So it's the job of the Dharma to connect us to it. Maybe that brings us back to the theme of the day and Dharma Day. And I know, again, you had a set of readings about the build-up to Dharma Day. Dharma Day, I'm guessing most people by this time in the day know this, but it marks the June-July full moon, and it's the occasion of the Buddha first. It is called teaching, right? But even that makes it something more formal than it is. It's the Buddha having had a couple of months of absorbing his own enlightenment experience, communicates it for the first time, manages to explain to somebody else the crux of what that experience was. So that's what Dharma Day is. It's that moment of communication. And the whole Buddhist tradition is just that experience of waking up, being communicated and passed on person by person, generation by generation. Let me give you some pictures. Just bear with me for a moment. I just wanted that back on just to make this segue to the next image. Okay, top right-hand corner of the fence. This is the Buddha going forth, the reading for which you got. And this fantastic image, again, this is one of these images from the Buddhist tradition that slightly makes my hairs on the back of my neck go up. So it's the prince getting rid of the princely robes, I think that's them on the back of the horse, cutting his hair and moving off, this commitment, moment of commitment to spiritual practice. The Enlightenment, this is perhaps not the most distinguished bit of Buddhist art you're ever going to see in your life. It's a detail, I think, from a tanka that the LBC owns of the Buddha's life story. And this is the Enlightenment. And I think one of the reasons it's worth having that image up is just to say that spiritual practice isn't always totally straightforward, right? And every now and again, I don't know if you've found this in your practice so far, that there's an emerging current, there's an emerging process, but every now and again you hit resistance, right? You think, okay, that's enough, I'm something else. So just this image of the Enlightenment, and at that moment of enlightenment, all of these sort of habits, deep habits that we're working against, you know, the traditional image of the arrows being fired, and as they touch the Buddha's meditative aura, they turn into flowers and fall at his feet. But just that relationship to the complexity of our own experience. And then finally, this is in a way what Dharma Day is celebrating. This is a teaching that traditionally is called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Dhammacakkappavattana just means turning the wheel of the Dharma. And again, when I was thinking about this talk, I just found myself making it kind of looking for personal equivalents. You know, I don't know when you think of the Buddha, if you think of the Buddha, quite what it is that you're bringing to mind. And you know, this idea of the first sermon and the five ascetics. But basically, you've had this guy on his own for a couple of months, just absorbing the enlightenment. He wants to teach it. And just the natural instinct is to want to talk to people he knows and people he likes. So his teachers he intuits are dead, and he goes looking for the people that he practiced with. But it's quite a difficult relationship. Like he's meeting again people who he broke with, not on good terms. The people, the five ascetics that he was practicing with, felt that he had really, you know, kind of reneged on his own spiritual practice. They felt he had sort of in a way betrayed them and gone off on his own. So this is him coming back into relationship with people with whom there's quite a complex dynamic, quite a complex emotional relationship. And he teaches the Four Noble Truths. Again, you had, you know, this is absolutely classic. The Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is the Buddha for the first time teaching suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path leading to the end of suffering. And again, it's easy to hear that as a bit of a cliche. If you know much about Buddhism, you probably know that that was the Buddha's first teaching. And it's one of the teachings that, you know, gets Buddhism a wee bit of a bad name as being pessimistic. One of the ways it gets translated is that Buddhism says that all conditioned existence is suffering. But I was thinking, really, that's not what the Four Noble Truths is about at all. At least one way of looking at the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha says himself, he only teaches two things. He teaches suffering and he teaches the cessation of suffering. And what's happening in the Dharmacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha's talking to people he practiced with for years. And he's saying, basically, in any moment of experience, there's two possibilities. Right? There's the possibility of responding to experience in a way that causes suffering. and there's the possibility of responding to experience in a way that moves you towards liberation, in a way that supports that move of growth. And, you know, like the classical teaching is that the cause of suffering is craving. The later traditions sort of amplified it. And it said, basically, there are three poisons in the mind. There's craving. And what craving is the habit of the mind. So somebody talked about the three poisons as pulling towards, pushing away, and going round in circles. So pulling towards is, in this fluid experience, you try to catch it, you try to fix it, you try to hold on beyond the kind of natural moment where that's possible. In a world where everything's impermanent, again, like the kind of basic teaching, somebody says that the basic human tragedy is we look for permanent satisfaction from impermanent experience. So craving's this attempt to get permanent satisfaction from impermanent experience. Aversion is pushing away any aspect of reality that we find threatening. And confusion is just we have no idea what's happening. Just the mind's in, you know, just not seeing experience clearly. And the traditional teaching, the cessation of suffering is just the opposite of that. So there's non-craving. And the later tradition talked about non-craving just as openness. A lovely kind of very simple rendering of that from an American teacher called Pema Chodron, when she talks about the great Buddhist virtue is curiosity. So rather than trying to hang on to one aspect of experience, it's just an openness, a responsiveness, an attentiveness to what's naturally arising, whatever it is. The opposite of the aversion, the pushing away, is just obvious, it's connection. So it's that habit of the mind to resist, to push away, and just out of that interest, what a Japanese teacher calls intimacy with life. It's a willingness to become connected to our own experience, a willingness to become connected to the world around us, to the people around us. And the opposite of confusion is clarity. You know, just what you do when you sit down on your cushion, you start to follow the breath. You're just teaching the mind how to be present to experience whatever that experience is. And basically what's being said, that the teaching of the Four Noble Truths is that in any moment of experience, we can respond out of resistance, we can try and push experience away, or we can start to pay attention, we can start to open up, we can start to connect. And in that opening, in that connecting, the conditions that allow that unfolding to happen, the liberation from suffering starts to become possible. So that's one way perhaps of looking at the Four Noble Truths. It's nothing to do with all existence being suffering. It's just noticing that suffering, like every other experience, comes about in dependence on conditions. And those conditions are craving, aversion, and confusion. And you take away the conditions, you take away the suffering. You create this move towards awakening. That's what the Four Noble Truths is trying to say. A little less well known, it was day two of the meeting with the five ascetics. Most people know about the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The Anattalakkhana Sutta isn't maybe quite as familiar. Everybody here in nodding terms with the Anattalakkhana Sutta, maybe not. Anattalakkhana Sutta, it's the Buddha coming back. Day one, somebody understood, one of the five ascetics called Kundanya, understood what the Buddha was getting at and had his own moment of awakening. And the Buddha, you get this moment in the scriptures, it obviously mattered to the Buddha that somebody understood him. So there's this little kind of outcry or kind of verse at the end of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is Kundanya knows. Candania being the guy. And ever after that, Candania was called. His name in Pali means Candania who knows. So Candania got it on day one. On day two, the Buddha went into what's probably the core Buddhist teaching of non-self. And I'm not even going to try and do it justice, but it's the most down-to-earth experience of non-self that you're going to come across. The later tradition got a bit metaphysical. In the Anattalakkhana Sutta, it's totally grounded. So if you want a nice, grounded experience of non-self, Anattalakkhana Sutta is one of the places to look at. But briefly, the Buddha says, if you look at... So he's got the five ascetics sitting around, and he says to them, OK, look at your body. Is there anything in your body that's permanent? And there's a wee pause, and they all go, no, there isn't. And he says, OK, look at how you feel. Is there anything in how you feel that's permanent? And they're all going, that's amazing, you're right, there isn't. And then look at your state of mind. If you look at what your mind's doing, anything in that experience that's permanent, there isn't. And then look at the whole field of experience. Are you looking at anything anywhere that's permanent? And just that, again, totally simply, with no metaphysics involved, just looking at your experience, everything that you're looking at is in a process of change, that there's nothing anywhere in your experience, should you choose to inquire into it, that you can find that isn't part of this changing, unfolding process. And what Buddhism's saying is, what the Buddha's saying, if I may be so presumptuous, is that anywhere you look, your experience is totally real. Everything that you touch, taste, smell, feel, think, is as vivid, as rich as you think it is, but just it's not separate the way we think it is. It's just that you're looking at something where no matter where you look, nothing in it. Forgot to mention dukkha, didn't it? That all experiences. So I'm thinking British four-stroke, but that can't be right. Just so to get back to the point, basic idea, wherever you look in your experience, it's as rich as you think it is, but there's nothing in it that's permanent, nothing in it that's separate. That's what's being said. That's got implications that go deep, right? But basically, that's the observation. And at that point, the other four ascetics get it. The other four ascetics recognise that they're looking at this unfolding process, nothing to hang on to, nothing that they need to hang on to. And you get this last little sequence in the Anattalakkhana Sutta, if I can find it in my notes. Seeing thus, the sutta says, the well-instructed practitioner grows disentangled from experience. I think that's a lovely word, disentangled. It's not that your experience is any less real. We're just not caught in it the way that we habitually are. There's a sort of an openness and a spaciousness around this flow. And then the Buddha says that disentangled, you become... The word that quite often gets translated is dispassionate. And dispassionate, I think, is totally wrong. The Pali word that dispassionate is translating is a Pali word, viragati, which means the end of viraga. And raga gets translated as passionate attachment. So it's this passionate holding on to little fragments of experience. And viragati sometimes gets translated as fading away. I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound any more attractive to me than dispassion. Right, but fading away comes from, this is my study again, I'm sitting in Wales and reading my books. Viragati, raga, one of the traditional images for raga is the mind as a piece of cloth being made dirty and stained by craving. And viraga is the craving starting to end. And what the metaphor of fading away is that dirt on the purity of the mind starting to fade and just leaving this pure, unsullied awareness. So you see the impermanence, there's a disentanglement. Out of that disentanglement comes a fading away of what we, you know, compulsively cling to. And the sutta ends up with, through viragati, we are fully liberated. So what you're getting described there is this process of the mind being liberated, starting to move finally past those habits of clinging, of pushing away. Now, again, like, I don't want to sort of labour this. I think, you know, you could spend years as a practitioner sort of looking more and more deeply into this. But in this, the day after Dharma Day, the Buddha's talking to the five ascetics, and the other four ascetics get what he's getting at. So there's this sort of shared experience of liberation. Yes, so coming back to this whole question, then, we sort of started off talking about this urge that we know is important, and maybe it's not always clear what it is that that urge is pushing us towards. I think in these two suttas, the Buddha's trying to describe, you're trying to get an image of what it is that we're moving towards. It's a direction that the mind's moving in, out of that confusion, and to use the traditional Buddhist language, into this experience of liberation, this experience of awakening. If enlightenment is, was it Bhante was saying, it's the term that Buddhism traditionally uses for what it is that we're trying to move towards. And again, just trying to move it away from the abstract, trying to move it away from the heights, and just turning it into that sense that we've got of what makes us most fully, deeply alive. The traditional term for that, one of the ways of talking about it, is enlightenment. There's another traditional term that describes our clarification around that, starting to understand more deeply what the conditions are that support that process of awakening. And it's the traditional terms going for refuge. I wanted to finish off just by saying something about going for refuge. One of the things that I'm quite involved in still in Sri Ratna is ordination training for men. And ordination is, in a sense, it's quite central to how we think about Dharma practice. I know I'm talking to a wide range of experience here, but I wanted to try and articulate a little bit about this language, this traditional term of going for refuge, and what ordination is in relationship to that. So the Pali term for going for refuge is saranang gacchami. And saranang is refuge. It's something stable, something secure. And gacchami is to move towards. So it's this sense, again, of the process of our experience, the process of our minds being an unfolding. And gacchami is starting to consciously direct that unfolding. We're not just moving, we're moving towards something. And traditionally, what you talk about in the Buddhist tradition is that you move towards Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So for some people in the room, this is going to be totally familiar ground. And the excuse on an occasion like this is that non-repetition is the canker of the teachings. Right? You can't hear some things too often. Right? So if this seems familiar, just bow in its direction as a useful truth. But so before it's anything else, like, again, just trying to get this fundamental image of something trying to grow. Everywhere you look, you're looking at something in movement. So what your practice is the shape that this movement is starting to take. It's what it is that we're moving towards. And the first of the images that we traditionally move towards is called, is the tradition calls it the Buddha. And there's two or three ways of thinking about the Buddha. I think one is it's the historical teacher. You know, the longer I practice Buddhism, the longer I practice the Dharma, the more appreciative I am. You know, like one of the things that I found in Glasgow in 1973 was I finally heard something that made sense to me, that I didn't find offended my reason, and that gave me a way of actually practicing that brought about a change. So there's something about the teaching of the Buddha that the Buddhist tradition, I think, is particularly clear and particularly practical. So going for refuge to the Buddha is that sort of, in a way, gratitude for what's been made available to us to the extent that we find it helpful. There's that. But there's a sort of second... I'll just give you a wee slideshow, actually. But a sort of second sense of going for refuge to the Buddha is, again, going back to this image of it's not always clear what it is that we're moving towards. And even the idea of enlightenment can very easily sound very metaphysical. And what you've got in the Buddha is this idea that what it is that you're moving towards is something embodied, it's something that's lived. And you're looking at the tradition trying to describe what enlightenment's like as a lived experience. You know, if you get a fine bit of Buddhist art, there was an exhibition at the Royal Academy a few years ago of these Chinese images that were illuminated from the inside, just this sense of an image of something absolutely delighted to be alive and awake. And what you're looking at when you're looking at the image of the Buddha, it's an attempt to just describe that push, what it is that we're moving towards. And maybe we resonate with that, maybe it's a helpful image, maybe it's not. But it's trying to give shape to that sometimes kind of incoherent urge. You get fantastic images. This is from the caves in Dunhuang in the Silk Road. It's an image of Avalokiteshvara, which I think must be an absolutely delightful little image. And the Buddhist tradition just keeps on giving you images. You get the peaceful images, you get wrathful images, male images, female images, just trying to give a form to what it is that we're moving towards. Going for refuge to the Dharma. Again, you've got the big truths. You've got the everything's impermanent, everything arises in dependence on conditions. But there's a text called the Chetokila Sutta, and it's another image of growth. Basically, what the Chetokila Sutta is about is what creates a desert and what creates growth. And in the Chetokila Sutta, it starts off saying, well, the Dharma supports growth. But then it takes another step, and it says not just the Dharma, but the training. And what the training is the Dharma starting to take concrete shape in our own practice. That there are some Buddhist teachings that will never make sense to all of us. Right? And there are some Buddhist teachings that you hear them and you recognise that's something that makes a difference to my experience. So what the training is, again, it's like any growth needs this urge from the outside and it needs the conditions that support it. So it's you starting to recognise those practices, those specific forms that in your experience support that process of growth. And it's making a commitment to engage with those conditions that start to support that current of growth. And in the end, it has to get specific. You know, like there's me on my retreat, and it got simpler and simpler and simpler till I was doing one practice every time I sat down to meditate, because you can feel in your own experience the impact that it's having. So commitment, going for refuge to the Dharma, is in your experience what supports that movement into openness, into awareness, and recognise how important it is. We've got all sorts of pushes. We're surrounded by the psychic equivalent of 1970s Mary Hill. Not all of the conditions that we've got access to support growth. So to start to be aware of what supports that process of growth and committing to it matters. And going for refuge to the Sangha is, and again, just this sort of obvious thing, the traditional language of the Sangha is the enlightened teachers who have passed on the Dharma. But in the Chittokila Sutta says, in the end, you've got to make connections with your companions in the spiritual life. And it's the people that we're practicing with that reflect us back. It's the people that we're practicing with that we see what mindfulness looks like as an embodied experience, or we see what a wee bit more emotional openness looks like as an embodied experience. And one of the deepest, most visceral ways that we learn is to see what we're trying to grope our way towards lived a little more fully in the people round about us. So in a sense, going for refuge to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha is that clarifying what it is that we're moving towards. You start to get, like, the language that I use might not be the language that does it for you, but you get a feel for what this deep, urgent push in you is trying to move towards. The Dharma are those conditions that support it. The Buddhist tradition says, on the whole, it's going to be practices that support awareness. It's going to be practices that move you away from an emotional self-reference into an awareness of other people and a responsiveness to other people. But the shape that that takes in you individually will have its own particular flavour. And the Sangha is the relationships that support it. And I was talking about ordination, and what ordination is really is just that process of growth. It's a marker. Like, the more people who join the order, from my point of view, the better. Right? To me, it's a sort of it's a symbol. It's a metaphor for committed practice. But really, underpinning it is each of us waking up to what supports that process of growth and consciously starting to cooperate with it. You're not having to create it. You know, like, you're not having to make yourself aware. All you have to do is to recognise this deep push towards growth that's an intrinsic part of our own mind, and to commit ourselves to setting up the conditions that support that. Last image. Friend of mine, a painter from Scotland, visiting our retreat centre, Adistana, and was out painting the Malverns on a rainy day. And she said, as far as she was concerned, she was painting the parable of the rain cloud. And the parable of the rain cloud comes from a Mahayana text called the White Lotus Sutra. And it's an image that the Dharma is like the rain. So this rain falls on everything. It probably works better as an image in India, where the rain's usually welcome, right? But it says that the land is cooled, the water falls, and everything grows. So a single rain. But then what it says is everything grows according to its own nature. Some of it's grass, some of it's flowers, some of it's trees. And just this mystery, actually, that a single set of conditions that move into awareness and openness finds an expression in our own absolutely distinct, unique experience. And what we're doing, in a way, what the Buddha did in the Dharma Day 2,500 odd years ago was what he called a showing of the way, right? It was just saying, look, this is possible. And what we're being invited to do, the traditional language is the language of ehipasiko, which means it's of the nature of a personal invitation. Just each of us, at the level that that image of growth makes sense to us, at the level where those conditions we can feel in our own experience supports that process, the important thing is to start the move in the direction that the Buddha pointed out.